Welcome to the January Dermatologic Surgery Digest podcast and Beyond the Digest supplemental podcast. I'm the podcast editor, Naomi Lawrence. In this month's journal, we have a single center retrospective study on bleeding complications associated with novel oral anticoagulants. As most of us do not take our patients off their anticoagulants, it's nice to see that these newer agents are not associated with increased postoperative bleeding unless combined with aspirin. In Beyond the Digest, we have reviewed an article from the Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery Journal that evaluates the efficacy, safety, and prognosis of intra-arterial thrombolytic treatment in a hospital setting performed by interventional radiology or neurosurgery in reversing hyaluronic acid related visual deficits. It is so important that we understand the work that is done in other specialties related to this complication and the evolving standard of care for treating it. Thank you for listening and have a happy surgery day.
This segment of the episode features surgical oncology and reconstructive article reviews.
This is Jordan Lim reviewing the original article titled Postoperative Bleeding Complications Associated with Novel Oral Anticoagulants in Mohs Micrographic Surgery by first author Lauren Fahmy and senior author Faramar Sami. This article is a five-year retrospective chart review building on results of prior studies. It assesses the risk of Mohs-related bleeding complications in the largest cohort of patients on NOACs to date and compares them with patients on traditional or no antithrombotic therapy. All patients included were instructed to continue their antithrombotic agents, and a bleeding complication was defined as an event requiring intervention within 6 weeks after Mohs surgery. Just over 2,000 cases were included, 31% were on antithrombotic therapy, and 1.01% of patients had bleeding complications. These complications were more likely to occur in those on antithrombotic therapy, but no other factors were significant, such as defect size, location, or repair type. NOAC monotherapy and aspirin monotherapy were not associated with an increased bleeding risk compared to no antithrombotic therapy on univariate and multivariate analysis. Notably, those on NOAC plus aspirin or multiple non-NOAC antithrombotics did have increased odds of bleeding complications on multivariate analysis. The findings of this study are similar to those of previous smaller reports that NOACs can be safely continued in the perioperative setting for dermatologic surgery. Interestingly, the increased risk of bleeding in patients on both NOACs and aspirin simultaneously has been also noted in the cardiovascular literature. Despite these findings, the authors do not generally suggest withholding NOACs and/or aspirin prior to dermatologic surgery, as the associated bleeding events in this study did not impact long-term outcomes. They do, however, highlight a retrospective study reporting that stopping NOACs for dermatologic surgery was associated with a low incidence of thrombotic events in patients with non-valvular AFib or a history of DVT or PE. As such, they conclude that it may be reasonable to consider NOAC interruption if a surgeon is expecting to perform significant undermining or a large flap and the interruption is approved by their prescribing physician. This article was limited by its single center design and small cohort of bleeding events, limiting the power of the study to detect small differences between groups. It also did not record antithrombotic medication dose, hematologic laboratory parameters, or supplement use.
This is Deirdre Connolly reviewing the original investigation, CAPABLE, a scoring system utilizing patient-reported measures to evaluate patient experience following Mohs surgery. First author Matthew Fox, senior author Justin Leitenberger. The authors sought to determine whether a postoperative satisfaction assessment, the so-called CAPABLE score, aligned with overall patient satisfaction after Mohs. This was a cross-sectional survey-based study of patients presenting for their first post-op visit after Mohs surgery. The CAPABLE survey was a title based on the post-operative questions included, including clarity of post-op instructions, adequacy of instructions on activity limitations, whether post-op pain was controlled, quality of access to a provider in the post-op period, and whether post-op bleeding was controlled. This was shortened to the acronym CAPABLE. This was followed by two overall satisfaction questions taken from the outpatient and ambulatory surgery consumer assessment of healthcare providers and systems survey. The pilot study took place at the University of Texas Dell Medical School. In the single-site Phase 1 pilot study, the primary research question was whether CAPABLE scores corresponded to overall patient satisfaction, and the secondary question was whether individual components of the overall CAPABLE score independently corresponded to overall satisfaction. In the subsequent Phase 2 multi-site study, authors sought to validate the CAPABLE scores and whether they corresponded to overall patient satisfactions in different practice settings. In the pilot study of 137 patients and in the multi-site validation study of 206 patients, overall CAPABLE scores correlated positively with overall satisfaction. The authors concluded that the CAPABLE survey is a concise tool for assessing specific actionable components of the post-op patient experience in Mohs while correlating well with overall patient satisfaction.
This is Chrissy Regula reviewing the original article, an update and review of clinical outcomes using immunohistochemical stains in Mohs micrographic surgery for melanoma, by first author May Elgesh and senior author Anna Barr. The treatment of melanoma using Mohs surgery has traditionally been limited by difficulty in interpreting melanocytes using frozen sections. Immunohistochemical staining, or IHC, has revolutionized the surgical treatment of melanoma by being used as an adjunct to H&E to detect melanoma on frozen sections. This article provides an update and literature review of current IHC stains used in Mohs for melanoma and their clinical outcomes. Six stains were reviewed: MART1, SOX10, MIT-F, HMB45, MEL5, and S100. MART1 is highly used among Mohs surgeons. It is a cytoplasmic stain and is the current IHC stain of choice. In a recent survey of ACMS members, 91 to 98% of Mohs surgeons who do IHC for melanoma use MART1 in their protocol. Except for desmoplastic melanoma, high rates of sensitivity and specificity for detecting melanoma and high concordance with permanent sections have been reported for MART1. One prospective cohort study showed the sensitivity to be 95.3% and specificity to be 95.1%, and several other studies have shown similar rates. Use of IHC stains has also been shown to decrease the risk of tumor recurrence. Few studies, however, have investigated MART1 compared to other commonly used IHC stains. SOX10 is a nuclear transcription factor involved in the differentiation of melanocytic cells and has high sensitivity for detecting melanoma in paraffin-embedded sections. SOX10 has not been as widely adopted as MART1, and there are far fewer comparative studies demonstrating efficacy in Mohs. A major strength of SOX10 is its identification of desmoplastic melanoma, which does not stain well with MART1 or HMB45. MIT-F is a nuclear stain that has less literature to support its use, but has shown promise in differentiating melanocytes from pigmented keratinocytes and lichenoid infiltrates. It has been proposed as an alternative to MART1 because of its more specific nuclear staining pattern, which may prevent false positive margins in chronically sun-damaged skin. HMB45 was also reviewed, but few studies examined the sensitivity and specificity of HMB45 in Mohs for melanoma, and the results have been mixed. One study reported a high sensitivity of 100% and specificity of 95%, while another found it to be less sensitive than MART1. S100 is a nuclear end cytoplasmic stain commonly used as a marker for melanoma because of its high sensitivity, ranging from 97 to 100%. The major limitation is its low specificity, as it is also expressed in benign melanocytic lesions, nerve sheath cells, myoepithelial cells, adipocytes, Langerhans cells, and chondrocytes. Its routine use in Mohs is limited, but may be the most sensitive marker for spindle cell and desmoplastic melanoma subtypes. MEL5 is an antibody to a glycoprotein expressed in melanocytic lesions, which have been used with a low recurrence rate in lentigo maligna and lentigo maligna melanoma. However, the studies are limited. Overall, further investigations are needed to define best practices and standardizing techniques when using frozen section IHC in the treatment of melanoma.
This is Ashley Decker reviewing the original article, Liposomal and Non-Liposomal Bupivacaine for Mohs Surgery, a systematic review by Doctors Jehad and Kelly. Lidocaine is the most common analgesic used in Mohs, but wears off shortly. Over 30% of patients experience intraoperative pain during Mohs, with nearly 80% reporting pain in the days after surgery. Postoperative pain decreases overall patient satisfaction and increases postoperative opioid use. In addition to its short half-life, the recent national lidocaine shortage highlights the need for Mohs surgeons to investigate alternative techniques of local anesthesia. Bupivacaine is an alternative to lidocaine and, in comparison, has a lower pH and slower onset. However, its duration of action is 4 to 8 hours compared to lidocaine, which is 1 to 2 hours without epi and 2 to 4 hours with. A novel form of liposomal bupivacaine, known as Exparel, came out recently can provide up to 72 hours of postoperative analgesia. After administration, the liposomes gradually break down, allowing for slow and sustained release of bupivacaine and longer duration of action. It's been studied in other surgical fields, but not within dermatologic surgery. This systematic review investigates the use of bupivacaine, traditional non-liposomal, and newer liposomal formulations within Mohs surgery. A total of 3 articles were included in this qualitative synthesis. The first article compared non-liposomal bupivacaine to placebo or saline and assessed postoperative pain and opioid consumption in Mohs flap reconstruction. Patients received either 0.5% bupivacaine or saline in a 1 centimeter grid around the flap immediately after recon. The placebo group had a statistically significant increase in tramadol use compared to the bupivacaine group. Pain scores were lower in the bupivacaine group in the first 8 hours, but remained similar between the groups after. The second article compared non-liposomal bupivacaine with epinephrine versus lido with epi. In this randomized controlled trial focusing on Mohs on the nose, all patients received lidocaine with epi at the beginning of stage 1 of Mohs and then were randomized into 2 groups at the end of stage 1. Group A received bupivacaine with epi, whereas group B received lidocaine with epi. Anesthesia effectiveness was assessed by testing sharp pain perception prior to either an additional stage or the repair, with none of the patients in the bupivacaine group having a positive pain response. The third article was a matched cohort study where liposomal bupivacaine was administered to the wound bed and surrounding skin before or after reconstruction in 14 patients undergoing large recon. Mean visual analog scale was similar at post-op day 0, 1, and 7, but on post-op day 3, the lidocaine group had a 1.6 point higher score compared to the liposomal bupivacaine group. The lower visual analog score on post-op day 3 could be due to the 72-hour duration of liposomal bupivacaine. The positive literature on this topic certainly indicates the need for additional larger studies to determine the generalizability and benefits of using bupivacaine within Mohs surgery.
This is Erica Levitt reviewing the original article, Looking Beyond the Hutchinson Sign, a retrospective study of clinical factors indicating the presence and invasiveness of nail unit melanoma in patients with longitudinal melanonychia by authors Sang Gun Lee and Mi Rung Ro. For background, longitudinal melanonychia can be a challenging condition for dermatologists, as nail unit melanoma is very much on the differential, but it can be difficult to distinguish clinically from benign lesions, and nail matrix biopsies are more invasive than standard skin biopsies. One proposed screening tool in the past has been the ABCDEF mnemonic, with A for age being highest prevalence in the 5th to 7th decades, B for brown to black color with a width 3 millimeter or more, C for changes in the band over time, D for digit with the thumb most commonly involved, E for extension of the pigment or Hutchinson sign, and F for family history of melanoma. This study contributes to past literature as another retrospective study evaluating the clinical factors associated with nail unit melanoma diagnosis in patients with longitudinal melanonychia at a single institution. 177 patients with longitudinal melanonychia were included. 80 of these had biopsy-proven nail unit melanoma. On multivariate regression analysis, the factors significantly associated with malignancy were high band color intensity, so darker colors, color variegation, nail plate splitting, Hutchinson sign, and band change over time. On a second analysis of the patients with nail unit melanoma, nail plate splitting was associated both with invasion and the depth of invasion. One limitation to the study is that not all benign longitudinal melanonychias were biopsy confirmed. Some were deemed benign based on no change over follow-up. However, some nail unit melanoma, particularly in situ, may be very slow growing and would have been missed in the study. Overall, this paper adds to the body of literature that found that nail band color change over time, nail plate changes such as splitting, and Hutchinson sign are poor prognostic factors. Yet this is still definitely a diagnostic challenge, as some malignant lesions are subtle and would not have any or all of these findings.
This is Christy Regula reviewing the original article, Predictor Variables Associated with Dermatology Referral Completion and the Impact on Surgical Treatment, a retrospective cohort study by first author Jonathan Lay and senior author Jeffrey Scott. Dermatologic issues are often first identified with the primary care setting, where detection of specific lesions may lead to referral to dermatology for evaluation. There may be a delay in dermatology evaluation at multiple stages, from the time it takes for the referral to be placed and the time that it takes for the referral to be completed. A delay in evaluation of suspicious lesions can lead to a delay in diagnosis and treatment, with the potential of increased morbidity and mortality. This retrospective study aimed to evaluate dermatology referrals from primary care providers for the evaluation of specified lesions of concern. This was a single institution retrospective cohort study. Outpatient dermatology referrals placed over a year by PCPs were evaluated. 6,203 referrals were identified. 2,638 were randomly selected for review. After evaluating for inclusion and exclusion criteria, 400 records of patients referred for a specific lesion of concern were reviewed. The medical records were reviewed to gather patient demographics as well as appointment dates and tumor characteristics. Patients were more likely to complete their skin referral if they had a previous history of skin cancer or a family history of skin cancer. Patients were more likely to have delayed referral completion beyond 30 days if they were ages 18 to 34, and patients with a previous history of skin cancer were less likely to experience delayed referral completion. Of the 304 patients that completed the referrals, 110, or 36.2%, underwent skin biopsies at their dermatology appointment. Of these biopsies, 58% were performed on the lesion of concern noted in the primary care referral. An average time from referral to biopsy was 34 days. This study is certainly limited by its retrospective nature, but identifies patients that are at risk for delayed or failed referral completion.
This is Michael Renzi reviewing the original investigation assessment of pain, healing time, and postoperative complications in the healing of auricular defects after secondary intent healing versus split thickness skin graft placement by first author Maria Sarah Bovenberg and senior author Leonard Goldberg. Reconstruction of auricular defects after Mohs micrographic surgery is challenging given the ear's prominence and complex three-dimensional architecture. Available options for reconstruction after tumor extirpation include secondary intent healing, local tissue flaps, split thickness skin grafts, or full thickness skin grafts. The cartilaginous ear, where the skin is naturally thin and contains little subcutaneous tissue, is a good location to employ split thickness skin grafts. Previous studies have demonstrated that second intent healing on the ear yields comparable results to full thickness skin grafts in complication rate, cosmetic outcome, and patient satisfaction, while offering lower infection and procedure costs. The authors of this study sought to evaluate postoperative pain, healing time, and postoperative complications of auricular defects after split thickness skin graft placement versus secondary intent healing. A total of 30 patients were recruited at the time of repair of the post-Mohs surgery auricular defect. After study enrollment, patients were assigned to the second intention group, received no further surgical intervention. The surgical wound was dressed with Surgifoam and a pressure dressing, with the instruction to keep the dressing dry and intact for 48 hours. Afterward, patients were instructed to wash the site daily with soap and water and keep covered with petrolatum and a clean bandage until healed. For the split thickness skin graft group, the graft was harvested from the hair-bearing scalp using a flexible double-edged razor blade. The harvested graft was then trimmed and fit to the surgical defect and secured with 5-0 nylon sutures. A bolster dressing and pressure bandage was then applied. Donor site was left to heal by second intention. Patients were instructed to keep the dressing dry and intact until the 1 week follow-up visit. A handout was provided to document maximum daily pain scores using the 0 to 10 numerical pain scale for the first week postoperatively starting on the night of surgery. Patients in the split-thickness skin graft group were asked to rate both surgical site pain and donor site pain. Patients were also requested to document daily postoperative analgesic use, if any. No prescription pain medications were provided. Follow-up visits were scheduled at 1 week and 1 month for both patient groups. At the 1 week follow-up visit, the bolster dressing was removed in the split-thickness skin graft group. During the 2 follow-up visits, patients were evaluated for postoperative complications, including continued pain, bleeding, scabbing, crusting, drainage, perichondritis or chondritis, infection, and suboptimal scar outcomes. Overall, patients in the split-thickness skin graft group experienced significantly more pain during the first 3 postoperative days than patients in the second intent group. Maximum pain was experienced on the night of surgery, with a mean pain score of 3.6 in the split-thickness skin graft group versus 0.8 in the second intent group. Pain decreased on a day-to-day basis and dropped below 1 on postoperative day 6 for the graft group. The second intent group had a mean pain score of 0 on most days. No patients reported pain after the first week. 56% of patients in the graft group reported use of over-the-counter pain medication during the first week versus just 7% in the second intent group, and this difference was statistically significant. Healing was significantly faster in the split-thickness skin graft group, with 87% of patients fully healed at 1 week versus just 21% in the second intent group. At 1 week, the mean percent re-epithelialization in the second intent group was 60%. No major complications such as postoperative bleeding, peri or chondritis, or surgical site infection were experienced. All patients reported satisfaction with their scar outcome. These outcomes indicate that both secondary intent healing and split thickness skin grafts provide excellent options for healing of auricular Mohs defects and can be used instead of extensive surgical reconstructions.
This is Erica Levitt reviewing the reconstructive conundrum, reconstruction of a nasal cartilage defect following Mohs micrographic surgery by authors Bertrand Shengyang Lan and Chun Chiat O. The patient was a 78-year-old immunocompromised patient with a full thickness 4x3 cm defect on the nasal tip, right ala, sidewall, and dorsum. There was partial removal of cartilage, septum, and mucosal lining of the right vestibule. A classic reconstruction for this defect would have certainly involved a paramedian forehead flap, but the authors chose a single-stage multimodal approach. I refer listeners to the paper for the full excellent description, but the repair involved a right-sided nasolabial transposition flap and a left-sided cheek advancement flap. The right nasolabial flap was thinned and turned inward to resurface the mucosal defect. A conchal cartilage graft was also used on the right side, and on the left, the remnant cartilage was advanced medially. I applaud the authors for this impressive single-stage repair for an extensive defect.
This is Michael Renzi reviewing the reconstructive conundrum, repair of a large defect involving the preauricular sulcus, temple, supraauricular scalp, helical root, upper helical rim, and tragus by first author Maria Bovenberg and senior author Leonard Goldberg. The authors described the repair of a 3.5 by 4.2 centimeter defect involving the preauricular sulcus, temple, and scalp, as well as the helical root, upper helical rim, and tragus following Mohs surgery for a squamous cell carcinoma. The authors considered several flaps, including O to L, O to T, and rotation flaps. However, these approaches would not significantly decrease closure tension, and importantly, most of these tissue reservoirs seem to originate from small pockets on the temple and hair-bearing scalp, as well as the inferior preauricular sulcus and jaw, rather than one large central reservoir. Instead, the authors performed a partial elliptical closure of the supraauricular temple and combined this with an inferiorly based V to Y flap and a split thickness skin graft to reconstruct the helical root and upper helical rim. This was a nice combination repair, and the outcome at 3 months can be seen in figure 2 of the article.
This is Erica Lovett reviewing the communication, How We Do It, Ad Hoc Immunohistochemistry for Challenging Mohs Cases by authors Emily Merkel and Ali Khan Samani. The authors present an ad hoc immunohistochemistry staining protocol that can be used on H&E stained or unstained slides obtained during Mohs. They state that this technique can be used when real-time immunostaining is unavailable and is an alternative to thawing the tissue block and sending for analysis in formalin, which has its own limitations. The protocol takes a little over 1 hour, and the hydrogen peroxide in the second step acts as a destaining reagent, removing any hematoxylin and eosin. I refer listeners to the complete protocol in the communication if interested.
This is Christy Regula reviewing the communication Locally Metastatic Basal Cell Carcinoma by first author Hannah Porter and senior author Glenn Goldman. This is the case of a 67-year-old woman with a history of several basal cells who presented with locally metastatic basal cell carcinoma involving the left axillary lymph node basin. Her history was significant for a superficial multifocal basal cell carcinoma of the left posterior shoulder, biopsied in November 2017. The patient opted to treat topically with 5-FU twice a day for 4 weeks. At follow-up 5 months later, there was clinical evidence of recurrent tumor, which was treated with 3 cycles of ED&C. 2 months later, the area was evaluated and treated with ILK for a hypertrophic scar. 6 months after that, a 2-centimeter firm telangiectatic tumor developed in the same location, and punch biopsy showed an infiltrative basal cell carcinoma. The patient then underwent Mohs surgery and surveillance every 6 months. 3 years later, she presented to her PCP for an annual physical and was found to have a palpable mass in the axilla, which was then biopsied as a basal cell carcinoma. The patient had a negative CT and no risk factors for metastasis, which include prior radiation, immunosuppression, or high-risk features of the tumor, such as nerve invasion on pathology. She underwent axillary lymph node dissection and will be followed every 6 months for skin exam and CT scan. And metastatic basal cell carcinoma is rare, with an incidence of 0.0028% to 0.55%. Risk factors include large size, history of radiotherapy, local recurrence, location in the central portion of the face or ears, evolution over a long period, perineural or perivascular invasion, possible immunosuppression, depth of invasion, duration of disease, and squamous differentiation. The median time between primary tumor and metastasis of basal cell carcinoma was 9 years. Metastatic basal cell carcinoma involving the viscera or bone should be treated with hedgehog pathway inhibitors, and if these entities fail, PD-1 inhibitors are used to treat locally advanced or metastatic basal cell carcinoma.
This is Ashley Decker reviewing the communication evaluation of the effects of surgical smoke during Mohs micrographic surgery in the VA population by Drs. Maris and Smith. The smell of surgical smoke created by electrocautery may decrease patient satisfaction and may elicit traumatic memories, especially amongst veterans. In this single-center study, a survey was given to 70 patients referred for Mohs from a VA outpatient dermatology clinic. Patients were asked 6 questions regarding military experience, the smell of surgical smoke, and any negative thoughts or experience the smell elicited. The same survey was also given to 70 civilian patients who were age and sex matched as the control group. 69% of the VA patients could smell smoke during the Mohs stages, and 47% could smell smoke during the closure. 13% of the VA patients experienced traumatic thoughts triggered by the surgical smoke, and 2/3 of these thoughts were related to combat. Within the civilian group, 57% smelled the surgical smoke during the Mohs stages, and 50% noticed smoke during the closure. 7% of patients reported the smoke brought back traumatic memories, with 25% of those patients reporting memories related to combat. Anxiety endorsed by the smell of surgical smoke was nearly the same between the groups at 16.6% and 17%. 5%. This study shows that the smell of surgical smoke can elicit negative responses related to trauma, specifically combat-related, in the VA population and can induce anxiety in both the VA and civilian populations, although level of anxiety overall was low in each group. The authors suggest using smoke evacuators to minimize the smell of surgical smoke and improve the patient experience.
This is Deirdre Connolly reviewing the communication, Pexing Precision in Nasal and Paranasal Reconstruction, the Nasal Vestibular Pexing Suture, author Waliat Hussein. The author describes a technique relevant to most dermatologic surgeons, that of the perinasal pexing suture. A review of the figures is important for this article. Over the past decade, the author has used this pexing suture method when performing any nasal or paranasal reconstruction, and he calls it the nasal vestibular pexing suture. A 4-0 braided absorbable suture is used when any cheek tissue is advanced medially onto the nose at the time of division and inset of any interpolated forehead or cheek-to-nose flap, and also when insetting local flaps or skin grafts. The curved needle is straightened manually using artery forceps in order to create a long enough needle to ensure that the pexing suture can be placed even when large or bulky flaps are advanced medially onto the nose. The first pass of the pexing suture is full thickness from within the nose and exits through the leading edge of the flap onto the medial cheek at the point chosen by the surgeon. The needle is then turned around and reinserted full thickness back into the nose, no greater than 1 to 2 millimeters away from the initial exit point of the first pass. The knot is then tied in a standard fashion within the nasal vestibule. The direct visualization and precise placement with which the pexing suture may be placed is an advantage inherent to the technique as compared with a periosteal tacking suture, because there is no flap to keep out of the way at the time of performing the suture. The author feels that the biggest advantage of this pexing suture over other tacking suture techniques, including a periosteal tacking suture, is that it may be placed retrospectively after completion of any reconstruction, and thus may be nuanced to optimize functional and aesthetic outcomes.
This is Michael Renzi reviewing the communication, How We Do It, Alar Advancement Flap for Small, Medially Based Alar Defects by first author Adrian Sain and senior author Neil Mortimer. Reconstruction of surgical defects of the ala present a challenge when attempting to restore normality during reconstruction. Meticulous attention must be paid to restoration of contour, color, and texture while avoiding distortion of the free margin and preserving symmetry. Mitkov and colleagues have previously described alar rotation flaps for small, medially based alar defects. The blood supply is based on the broad pedicle of the flap at the alar rim and is therefore robust. Mitkov and colleagues made the comment that the inferior standing cone must not cross the alar free margin to prevent distortion of this important landmark during the repair. The authors state that they notice an unsatisfactory downward bulge of the alar free margin at the point of this inferior standing cone, which distorts the normal gentle curvature of the margin and results in asymmetry. Therefore, the authors present a modification to prevent this downward protrusion. Listeners can find a detailed description of the flap procedure in the article. However, the key modification made by the authors is that the inferior standing cone is extended through the alar free margin. This modification was employed for 34 patients between February 2009 and July 2022, with a mean defect size of 9.6 millimeters by 7.2 millimeters. The authors report excellent aesthetic and functional outcomes. 3 patients had reduced ipsilateral airway patency, 2 of which were transient, whereas the other patient had a pre-existing condition to predispose them to reduced airway patency post-repair, and this was improved with intralesional steroid injection. The main limitation of this flap is the location of the defect, as it is best suited for small, predominantly vertically oriented defects at the medial first third aspect of the nasal ala.
This is Deirdre Connolly reviewing the communication, Porocarcinoma of the ear found to have cutaneous in transit and regional nodal metastasis, implications for management and importance of clinical exam. First author Hope Barone, senior author Laura Sowerby. Ecrine porocarcinoma is a rare cutaneous malignancy. An estimated 22% of cases present with metastatic disease. whereas 20 to 36% are estimated to develop metastasis after excision of the primary tumor. Associated mortality with regional lymph node involvement is as high as 67%. The authors report a case of an 81-year-old male with a biopsy-proven eccrine porocarcinoma of the left triangular fossa. Prior to Mohs, a papule without epidermal change in close proximity to the Mohs site was noted. Vertical section frozen biopsy at the time of Mohs was consistent with porocarcinoma, and this lesion was considered to be an in-transit metastasis. Both lesions were cleared with Mohs. No clinical lymphadenopathy was noted. Subsequent staging with PET CT revealed metastatic involvement of the left parotid and cervical lymph nodes. After a referral to ENT, a left parotidectomy and neck dissection were performed, the pathology of which demonstrated a metastatic poorly differentiated carcinoma involving the salivary gland with lymphovascular invasion and extensive nodal involvement. The patient was referred to radiation oncology for further management. No specific staging guidelines currently exist for eccrine porocarcinoma, given it is an infrequently diagnosed tumor. There is clear evidence regarding eccrine porocarcinoma's propensity for metastasis and poor prognosis, and as such, a regimented workup is warranted. The value of routine lymph node biopsy is uncertain, but should remain a consideration in the presence of high-risk pathologic features, even in the absence of clinical lymphadenopathy. It's important to perform a thorough clinical exam for cutaneous in-transit or satellite metastasis because of its potential correlation with nodal status, as in this case, and subsequent implications on management, such as addition of adjuvant therapies.
This is Ashley Decker reviewing the communications, how we do it, guiding curvilinear repair with partial secondary intention healing for reconstruction of Mohs defects on the alar groove by Drs. Bax and Weinberger, followed by the commentary on this communication by Drs. Richards and Kimai Asadi. Small defects within the alar groove may heal by second intention given its concavity. However, second intention healing for larger, deeper defects in this area can lead to contour deformity and free margin distortion, plus longer healing time. In addition to second intention healing, flaps and grafts can be utilized. In this communication, the authors describe a novel technique to reconstruct sub-centimeter defects of the alar groove or adjacent to the alar groove. I invite listeners to view figure 1 in the article for a breakdown of the defect location. Ideally, the defects would have the long axis of their wound oriented parallel to a tangent drawn from the curvature of the ala, but this is not a strict requirement. First, a marking pen is used to delineate two small, slightly curved Burroughs triangles along the contour of the crease extending from the defect. The standing cones are removed and minimal to no undermining is performed. If undermining is performed, it is along the outside edge to minimize displacement of the alar rim. A few buried horizontally oriented sutures are placed deep in the wound to partially approximate the depth without fully approximating the central wound edges to minimize distortion of the alar rim. The remaining second intent healing will help recreate a concavity along the native groove. The authors find this guiding curvilinear repair minimizes distortion of the alar groove and decreases risk of depressed pockmark scars and expedites healing, and they have used this repair for more than 100 patients in their practice. In the commentary to this communication, the authors review the technique and highlight a few potential complications, especially when used for larger defects, including vertical shortening, asymmetric arching, and notching of the nasal ala, as well as nasal valve compromise. The authors discuss the risk of nasal valve compromise due to stenosis of the nasal vestibule and consequent airway compromise. This risk is due to two factors, which include removal of the nasal skin, resulting in a relatively larger surface area of underlying mucosa, which trapdoors inward as the overlying skin is brought together. Second, the relatively loose mucosal tissue can sometimes develop chronic edema. Revision techniques for internal valve compromise include the three-point stitch and modified suspension suture. Nasal packing with dental rolls immediately after repair can help prevent collapse and mucosal edema. Intralesional cannula can also be used for the mucosal edema. Alternatively, reconstruction techniques for the alar groove defects include local flaps, such as a spiral flap, alar rotation flap, bilobe flap, and nasalis myocutaneous single pedicle flap. The authors highlight the importance of being aware of the benefits and drawbacks of each repair type and assessing the most appropriate repair type for each patient.
This is Jordan Lim reviewing the communication article titled Biodegradable Temporizing Matrix for the Reconstruction of Pyoderma Gangrenosum Wound by first author Inez Presta and senior author Peter Hirsch. This article describes the first published case of utilizing NovoSorb biodegradable temporizing matrix, further known as BTM in this article, for the management of pyoderma gangrenosum. The authors describe a 71-year-old woman with a large advanced and infected PG wound on the left lower leg with extensive tendon and muscle exposure, refractory to multiple immunosuppressive medications. After extensive surgical debridement, BTM was placed to establish a more viable wound base for future placement of a split-thickness skin graft. The BTM was sutured in place and was associated with immediate decreased pain after surgery. The post-op course was complicated by a subseal exudate that was drained and an infection at post-op day 58. On post-op day 81, neodermis was fully appreciated and a split-thickness skin graft was applied and successful. BTM is a unique dermal matrix as it has been effective in infection resistance and developing robust neodermis. It has been utilized with success in other conditions such as burns, necrotizing fasciitis, vasculitis, and denuded bone and tendons. I would refer the listener to the fantastic figures included in this article.
This is Erica Levitt reviewing the communication, efficacy, and safety of intralesional tranexamic acid injections in the treatment of postoperative scars, a split scar comparative study by authors Nuruddin Litayam and Faten Ziglau. This was a split scar study evaluating the use of intralesional tranexamic acid to treat hyperpigmented or erythematous postoperative scars. 12 patients with 15 scars were included in the study. Half of the scars with the worst erythema or pigmentation received monthly intradermal microinjections of tranexamic acid at concentration 100 mg per milliliter, up to 3 total sessions. The other half of the scar received intralesional saline, with a 5 mm area in between left untreated to avoid diffusion. Two dermatologists reviewed the scars using the vascularity and pigmentation variables in the OSAS scale, and there was significant improvement in the treated scars, but not in the controls. This was an interesting study suggesting promise for the use of IL tranexamic acid to help with vascular and pigmented scars, and I look forward to future larger scale studies on this topic.
This is Jordan Lim reviewing the communication article titled Intraoperative Use of Syringes as Scales of Measurement by Nikhil Mehta, Javner Kaur, and Sumish Gupta. This article describes the use of graduated syringes for measurement during procedures when a sterile ruler is not available. This method allows the reduction of medical waste by utilizing a piece of equipment that may already be on the surgical tray. The authors recommend utilizing the syringes as a scale of measurement when considering design of an ellipse or flap. They also recommend determining the conversion interval between millimeters and markings on the syringe to allow the surgeon to document true measurements with the syringe. I would refer the reader to the diagrams in this article for depiction of this surgical pearl.
This segment of the episode features general dermatologic surgery and cosmetic article reviews.
This is Megan McLean reviewing the original investigation, a triple combination therapy using a 2 mm biopsy punch for the treatment of multifocal keloids by Taehwan Park. Keloid treatment is challenging, with treatment options ranging from intralesional steroid injections to surgical excision followed by radiotherapy. In the introduction, the author highlights previous research on keloids from 2015, which demonstrated that the innermost collagen, termed proliferating core collagen, serves as a proliferating center for keloids and plays a critical role in their growth and recurrence. With this in mind, the author sought to assess the efficacy of 2 mm punch excisions combined with intralesional steroid injection and radiation therapy for multifocal chest keloids, which complete excision would not be feasible. The author followed 30 patients treated with triple combination therapy over the course of 19 months at a single hospital. Please see the methods for inclusion and exclusion criteria. Patients were placed under IV sedation and numbed with local anesthesia. A 2 mm punch biopsy was used to punch a single hole as deeply as possible, and then additional punches were performed in the surrounding dermal keloid tissue. The author states that this was combined with complete excision on a case-by-case basis in keloids that were too thick for the punch to go completely through the tissue. Please see figure 1 and 3 for a photo demonstrating the appearance of the keloids after this treatment. Up to 2 cc's of triamcinolone acetonide from 10 to 40 mg per milliliter was injected after the punch-assisted excision. Within 8 to 9 hours of the surgery on the same day, a single fraction of electron beam radiation from 10 to 11 gray was administered. Patients were followed for at least 12 months. The primary outcome was defined as recurrence versus non-recurrence, or in cases where some keloid tissue was left behind, as aggravation versus remission. The secondary outcome was patient satisfaction using the Patient Observer Scar Assessment, or POSAS 2.0 scale. 30 patients met the inclusion and exclusion criteria. All of the patients were reported to have achieved remission or non-recurrence. The postoperative course was reported to be routinely uneventful. The combination therapy resulted in statistically significant improvement of all the items in the POSAS 2.0 scale. In the discussion, the authors attribute the complete response to treatment to the removal of the innermost proliferating core of keloids using the 2-millimeter punch technique. They also highlight the minimally invasive nature of the technique and the fast healing time as compared to a large excision or flap. They highlight limitations to their therapy, including when thick keloids, where the punch cannot penetrate the entire depth, and as mentioned previously, in these cases, they converted to complete excision intraoperatively. There are several limitations to the study. It's difficult to assess how much improvement is from the individual components of the combined treatment. Many community dermatologists may not have access to radiation therapy for keloid patients, and it's unclear how much the electron beam radiation contributed to the lack of recurrence. Additionally, the data is unclear as to how many patients were converted from partial to complete excision, and this information would be important in assessing the efficacy of this combined procedure.
This is Monica Bowe, and I'll be reviewing the efficacy and safety of precision cryotherapy to treat seborrheic dermatitis of the scalp by first author Yanggu Choi and last author Wonsur Kim. The authors use a new cryotherapy device that precisely controls the skin temperature to negative 5 degrees Celsius. And this has the effect of reducing pruritus. And so the authors have decided to use precision cryotherapy device to treat seborrheic dermatitis of the scalp. This was done in Korea, and enrolled patients had moderate inflammatory seborrheic dermatitis of the scalp, and they were scheduled to undergo 3 precision cryotherapy treatments at 2-week intervals. For this procedure, the entire scalp was treated with this device at the target temperature of negative 5 degrees Celsius. Total treatment time was actually only 240 to 360 seconds. And once again, 3 treatments were performed. There was a pruritus scale that was assessed, global physician assessment, erythema index, and also transepidermal water loss were calculated at the hairlines. So in this study, a total of 24 patients were enrolled, and the itch score decreased by 50% at week 8. And then blind investigators showed that there was improvement in physician global assessment scores and an average erythema index decrease of 19.6% at week 8. And side effects were minimal. Some patients notice a little exacerbation of dandruff. So the main mechanism of conventional cryotherapy is to produce cell destruction and causes these intracellular ice crystals within the cells. And so there's different cells which have different target temperatures for necrosis, negative 4, negative 7 for melanocytes, we'll review negative 20, negative 30 Celsius for keratinocytes, and fibroblasts range from negative 30, negative 35 Celsius. And so the goal of using this negative 5 degrees Celsius was to be above that cell destruction threshold and causing apoptosis of the cells of seborrheic dermatitis while inducing immune tolerance or immune suppression rather than an inflammatory response during necrosis, like when we use cryotherapy for treating actinic keratoses. In this study, the pruritus of the scalp dramatically improved, and cooling has been used in other conditions to improve pruritus. And there also was a physician global assessment. So this could be another therapy in treatment-resistant seborrheic dermatitis of the scalp.
This is Deirdre Hooper reviewing the original article, A Comparison Between Hyaluronic Acid Filler and Dermofat Grafts with or Without Tie-Over Dressing for Lip Augmentation by Bilsev Ince and Mehmet Dedaci out of Turkey. This was a super interesting retrospective study of patients who underwent upper lip augmentation with either HA filler, which was Juvederm, or derm fat grafting between January 17th and April 2020. Its purpose was to look at factors that influence patient choice of method of lip augmentation, and also to look at the durability and predictability of dermofat grafting in the lip. So patients were allowed to self-select into one of three groups. The first group was treated with HA, the second underwent augmentation with the fat grafting, and the third received the fat grafting with a tie-over bolster dressing left sutured in place on the upper lip for 4 days. And the purpose of that dressing is to prevent large movements of the lips in the hopes of increasing the viability of the graft. Details of the fat grafting procedure, which involves preparing a single cord of graft harvested from the inguinal region and threading it through the submucosa, are well explained in the paper. Larger graft volumes were purposely used in the group that elected not to have the tie-over dressing in anticipation of some fat loss. So 56 patients were included in the results. 22 of these chose HA, 18 chose to receive their dermofat grafting without tie-over dressing, and 16 chose fat grafting with the tie-over dressing. The average HA volume used was 0.9 cc, and the average fat graft volume was 1.9 cc for the non-tie-over group and 1.6 cc's for the tie-over group. Results were calculated using the lip index, which multiplies height and projection. The lip index increased significantly and similarly in all groups at month 6. At month 12, all groups were still improved, but the HA group lost significantly more of its 6-month improvement compared to the grafted groups. Satisfaction scores were high and similar among the groups. There was no difference in complication rates among the three methods. 2 patients in the HA and 1 in the fat graft without tie-over had ecchymosis, 1 in the fat graft without tie-over had hematoma, and 1 in the tie-over group had infection with partial graft loss. There are several very nice before and after photos in the paper. In the discussion, the authors focus on 2 issues: the why of choosing a graft versus a synthetic HA, and how to maximize graft outcomes. Fat grafts have risks of donor site morbidity and risk of unpredictable resorption. The authors believe immobility provided by tie-over dressing decreased resorption and enhanced outcomes. HA fillers have a higher cost and a risk of foreign body reaction. So in conclusion, dermofat grafts with or without tie-over dressing may be considered as a reliable and inexpensive choice for lip augmentation with increased durability over hyaluronic acid. The study was limited by small patient numbers.
This is Ardalan Minokhetti discussing the manuscript Home Use Hyaluronic Acid Jet Injectors, Unreliable and Unsafe, from our colleagues in the dermatology group at the Amsterdam UMC location at the University of Amsterdam in the Netherlands. The premise of this manuscript is that it's a study that explores the use of jet injectors, a technique gaining popularity for delivering hyaluronic acid fillers in contrast to traditional hypodermic needle injections. These jet injection tools are widely available online, and ultimately they're propelled by high-velocity fluid streams that aim to overcome drawbacks such as pain and needle stick injuries associated with needle injections. The goal of the study was to explore the efficiency of the injection and biodistribution patterns administered with home use or spring-loaded jet injectors, abbreviated SLP, or commonly referred to as hyaluron pens, compared with medical jet injectors or electronically controlled pneumatic jet injectors or EPI, and also to assess safety aspects. So the study was an ex vivo human skin study. They used 2 of the EPI devices and 4 of the SLI devices. Figure 1 shows 4 of the SLI devices used. Figure 2 indicates results from the hyaluronic acid testing that showed intracutaneous doses that are calculated. And interestingly, the cutaneous biodistribution of hyaluronic acid was assessed using an innovative 3D imaging tool to visualize the biodistribution of hyaluronic acid using fluorescent device imaging. And the results shown in Table 1 and Figure 3 reveal that home use injectors showed a very low and variable distribution volume, while the medical grade, the EPI injectors, demonstrated more consistent and clinically relevant results. The injected dose of hyaluronic acid into the skin was found to be relatively minimal with the home use devices, targeting primarily the superficial epidermal distribution area with low volumes of distribution, ultimately suggesting poor clinical performance. In terms of safety, they looked to see if the devices had a manual, the mark of the European Union, a CE mark, to assess whether or not safety has been tested and if there was a good quality of the manufacturer and that it's met high safety and health standards. And ultimately, a conclusion, the findings of the study cast doubt on the effectiveness, reliability, and safety of specific combinations of home use jet injectors and hyaluronic acid. So we really need to have further studies to optimize these devices, and really they do not seem to work as well as advertised. So as the demand for facial enhancement continues to rise, we need to understand the potential risks associated with these procedures that will be critical not only for our practitioners, but also our patients.
This is Michael Renzi reviewing the original investigation, complications, treatment, and outcomes of self-injecting substances into the face, a systematic review by first author Natika Tripathi and senior author Eugenia Chu. The demand for minimally invasive facial cosmetic procedures has been rapidly increasing. Given the potential risks of injecting dermal fillers, the United States FDA has classified neurotoxins and injectable fillers as prescription medications and medical devices, respectively, limiting purchase and administration of such substances to licensed healthcare providers. Nevertheless, the high demand of injectable cosmetics has been met with an increase in their availability through direct-to-consumer online retailers. The ease of availability in tandem with an ever-growing number of unregulated injection tutorials on online forums and social media platforms heightens the number of inadvertent complications from unsuspecting consumers interested in self-injecting neurotoxins and fillers. The objective of this systematic review was to analyze complications, treatment, and outcomes associated with self-injecting fillers into the face. PubMed and M-based databases were searched from inception to September 10, 2022, to identify studies pertaining to self-injection of facial fillers. 16 key phrases were searched throughout both databases, and searches were limited to articles in the English language. After two stages of screening by two of the authors, 15 articles describing 38 complications among 18 patients were included in the data collection. All study results were summarized in the supplemental digital content. 1. The most commonly injected substance was hyaluronic acid at 76.4%. The lips were the most commonly site-injected at 33%, followed by the cheeks at 22%. The most reported complications were edema at 61% and erythema at 28%. Acute vascular compromise was reported in two cases at 11%. Acute hearing loss was reported in one case, 5%. The most common intervention was use of hyaluronidase and or antibiotics at 87.5%. Surgical intervention was required in two cases, or 11%. Patients generally healed after treatment, although residual localized hyperpigmentation was noted among 11% of patients. This article highlights the risks associated with at-home injections, which is made easier by the increased commercial availability of neurotoxins and fillers. Providers should be aware of the increasing prevalence of self-injectors and treatment options associated for complications associated with this practice.
This is Megan McLean reviewing the original investigation, Optimal Changes Seen in Patients After Treatment with Poly-L-Lactic Acid, a retrospective descriptive study by Inbar Alkotzer et al. Poly-L-Lactic Acid, or PLLA, is a synthetic polymer that, when injected, stimulates collagen and leads to volume restoration. It is approved in the U.S. for correction of shallow to deep nasolabial folds and other facial wrinkles, as well as correction of lipoatrophy in patients with HIV. The purpose of this retrospective study was to descriptively characterize the main changes produced from optimal results after treatment with PLLA to the facial area. This is a retrospective single-center photographic review over 17 months of patients treated with 2 to 3 sessions of PLLA. Injections were performed by a single injector with a 9 milliliter dilution using a 22 gauge 70 millimeter cannula and focused in the lateral midface complex. Please see figure 1 for a schematic of the injection locations. There were 203 patients who received PLLA alone over the study period and who were eligible for review. Photographs from baseline and 6 to 9 months after the third treatment were taken with a Vizia skin analysis system and reviewed by 3 independent physicians. Each study patient was rated on a scale of 1 to 5, with 5 representing dramatic positive changes from treatment. Of 203 patients, 12 received a rating of 5 by all 3 physicians. Those 12 photo pairs were then sent to 31 injectors and aesthetic experts worldwide for review. The evaluators were then asked to write 1 to 3 free text descriptions of the main changes from each pair of optimal treatment images. This data was then reviewed. Please see figures 1 and 2 for representative cases of patients who achieved a score of 5. In the 12 patients with optimal results, an average of 3.8 vials were injected overall as compared to 3.2 in the non-selected patients. All patients were female with an age range of 42 to 63 years and an average age of 52.3 years in the included patients and 51.3 years in the overall sample. 1,015 free text descriptions were reviewed and categorized. Nonspecific or unrelated comments were excluded. The number of categories was narrowed down to 5, 1 being improvement of facial contouring and enhancement of the lateral face, 2 lifting effect and its impact on major folds, 3 global improvement of skin texture and resurfacing, 4 improvement of skin tightness and firmness, and 5 contouring and enhancement of the lower third of the face. See Table 2 for more details on these findings and the free text descriptions included in each category. In the discussion section, the authors reflect that their study supports prior publications in demonstrating that PLLA injections redefine and enhance the lateral midface, the lateral lower third of the face, provide lifting effects, and improve skin quality. The discussion section is a worthwhile read for those interested in a summary of findings of prior publications on PLLA injections. The study is limited by the small sample size of only 12 patients who achieved these optimal results and the inclusion of only female patients. The treatments were also heterogeneous, making it difficult to draw clear conclusions. Additional areas of study may establish more standardized injection protocols, more standardized scales, or seek to establish an understanding of what makes some patients optimal responders as opposed to non-responders.
This is Isabella Jones reviewing fractional CO2 laser combined with autologous nanofat injection versus fractional CO2 laser combined with platelet-rich plasma in the treatment of atrophic acne scars, a split-phase comparative study with optical skin imaging by Rage and Ibrahim. The authors wanted to assess the efficacy of nanofat versus platelet-rich plasma as an adjuvant therapy to fractional CO2 laser for atrophic acne scars. The authors believe these procedures may be able to have synergistic effects with CO2 and lessen side effects by accelerating tissue regeneration and wound repair. For those less familiar with nanofat, the authors write that it provides stromal vascular fraction cells and adipose tissue-derived stem cells that stimulate angiogenesis and release growth factors. In the study, 35 patients with atrophic acne scars received 3 sessions of fractional CO2 laser at 1-month intervals on both sides of the face, followed by intradermal PRP injections on the left side of the face. A single session of nanofat was injected into the right side of the face 2 weeks before the laser sessions. The evaluations were conducted 3 months after the final session of laser. The authors describe in detail how nanofat was prepared after tumescent liposuction and how PRP was prepared. The endpoints included a quantitative Goodman and Barron score based off of photos and a skin analysis using an indentation index with an Intera camera. After treatment, the side treated with nanofat showed a significant reduction in Goodman scores and the indentation index of the Intera camera, while the PRP side showed a significant difference in Goodman scores, but not in the indentation index with the Intera camera. The difference between the two sides was statistically insignificant. The authors conclude that while no significant difference was detected between the two modalities, a single session of nanofat injection showed at least comparable results to three sessions of PRP injections in the improvement of acne scars when they combine these modalities with CO2. Note that in this study, no patients were treated with CO2 alone. This is Isabella Jones reviewing alternating treatment with non-ablative fractional laser and radiofrequency microneedling for the treatment of acne scars, a prospective randomized split-face study by Hartman and Goldman. A prior study on atrophic acne scars has shown that combining non-ablative fractional laser with RF microneedling was more effective than fractional laser alone. Since performing two treatments on a single day can be painful and expensive, the authors wanted to see if alternating both treatments would be superior to non-ablative fractional laser by itself. In this double-blinded split-face clinical trial, 20 patients with atrophic acne scars with skin types 2 through 4 had their facial halves randomized to receive either non-ablative fractional laser alone or laser alternating with RF microneedling. Patients received 4 treatments at 4-week intervals. The authors described their settings and their methods. 90 days after the final treatment, both facial halves demonstrated a significant improvement in their mean global ECCA score, which was a score they were using to look at the atrophic scars. The average percent improvement at the final endpoint was between 20 to 30% from baseline. No significant difference was noted between the facial halves for the mean ECCA score or the percent improvement at any time point. The authors conclude that although both non-ablative fractional laser and RF microneedling are safe and effective in the treatment of atrophic acne scars, alternating the two modalities does not seem to be superior to non-ablative fractional laser alone.
This is Tara Jennings reviewing the article Applicability of Patient-Reported Outcome Measures to the Aesthetic Medicine Patient Archetypes by first author Simone Roche and senior author Vince Bertucci. As societal acceptance of aesthetic medicine grows, clinicians are encountering greater patient diversity with respect to race, ethnicity, age, gender, and mindset. Although rejuvenation was the primary motivator that launched the industry, new patients with different needs are increasingly turning to aesthetic medicine. A previous study titled Going Beyond Beauty Initiative provided a way to simplify the path to patient motivation for receiving an aesthetic procedure by identifying patients by their primary archetype. The predominant patient archetypes identified by the study were identified as the following. 1. The positive aging archetype. These patients have a rejuvenation focus who are motivated to address the signs of facial aging. They'll usually seek subtle changes that will make them look like a better version of themselves. 2. The beautification archetype. These patients are motivated to increase their attractiveness and are influenced by trends, fashion, social media, and treatments that are popular in celebrity circles. 3. The transformation archetype. These patients are interested in achieving a specific beauty ideal to improve their societal status or increase their competitive edge. Their motivation for treatment may be associated with pressure related to achieving a specific societal or gender ideal that is culturally based. 4. The correction archetype. These comprise individuals motivated to address a flaw in their appearance that they believe has negatively impacted their life. Measuring what patients think about aesthetic treatments in a scientifically sound manner can be accomplished by asking them to complete patient-reported outcome measures, or PROMs. These PROMs are valuable in understanding the patient motivations, setting expectations, and ensuring satisfaction. This study was a review of the PubMed database for studies using PROMs to evaluate the motivations and expectations of aesthetic patients. The purpose of this article is to review the most relevant PROMs in aesthetic medicine and focus on their ability to capture the needs and motivations of the various aesthetic patient archetypes I described prior. The results of the study showed only 7 PROMs that have been validated and used in studies for non-surgical aesthetic medicine. The following 7 validated questionnaires were the following. The Facial Line Satisfaction Questionnaire, or the FLSQ. The Facial Lines Outcome, or the FLO. Facial Lines Treatment Satisfaction, or the FTS. Self-Perception of Age, or the SPA. Dermatology Life Quality Index, or the DLQI, Skindex, and FaceQ Aesthetics. The authors then did a review of these 7 validated PROMs through the lens of how well they address the concerns that matter to each of the 4 patient archetypes. None of the tools could universally represent the individual motivations and expectations of all 4 patient archetypes, but the FaceQ aesthetics had the broadest ability to capture the needs of the different patient types. Authors then identified ideas for improving the scoring system to better encompass the 4 archetypes. Overall, this was an excellent study demonstrating a need for updated scales that better reflect evolving treatment goals and are applicable to all 4 patient archetypes.
Monica Bowen, and I'll be reviewing immediate cryotherapy after core excision, a promising approach to reduce mechanical tension in crousting keloids, from the authors coming from South Korea, Jin Wongjung, and last author Byung Hung Ho. So they propose this combination approach for crousting keloids that involves a core excision and simultaneous cryotherapy. And they performed a retrospective analysis in 10 patients, 15 keloids. The procedure was as follows. They did a tumescent anesthetic technique, and a superficial incision was made inside the keloid using a number 15 scalpel. The skin of the keloid was filleted and acted as a flap. And then they removed the fibrous core of the superficial layer of the keloid. And afterwards, they did cryotherapy to the entire wound for about 10 seconds, only one free cycle. They then trimmed the redundant flap, and the wound was closed without tension using a 5-0 Vicryl. They noticed a reduction in the Vancouver Scar Scale score of 9.3, decreased to 5.8, and the height and pliability of the categories exhibited very substantial improvements. The authors hypothesized that this combination of cryotherapy and core excision benefited because there's less damage to the epithelium, with the cryotherapy going a little bit deeper, so less hypopigmentation, and also the cryotherapy allowed for deeper application of this cryotherapy technique. So hopefully this can help some of your patients with recalcitrant keloids using this combination approach.
Welcome to Beyond the Digest, offering bonus content covering surgical articles in dermatologic literature outside the peer-reviewed journal Dermatologic Surgery. Reference the episode description for publication details of the content covered.
This is Elizabeth Cusick reviewing the original article entitled Atypical Fibrosanthoma and Pleomorphic Dermosarcoma, Local Recurrence and Metastasis in a Nationwide Population-Based Cohort of 1,118 Patients, by first author Dr. Orholt and senior author Dr. Vester Golowinski. The article begins by providing the background that the prognosis of patients with atypical fibrosanthoma, also known as AFX, and pleomorphic dermal sarcoma, also known as PDS, remains uncertain, and there are no standardized evidence-based follow-up programs that have been established for the duration of follow-up, risk factors, or recommendations for radiological imaging. The objective of this retrospective cohort study was to recommend a standardized follow-up program of patients with AFX and PDS based on nationwide long-term estimates of local recurrence and metastasis that provide 5-year and 10-year estimates of local recurrence and metastasis and analyze the risk factors associated with them. Patients with AFX and PDS were included in Denmark between 2002 and 2022. The Danish National Registries were used to estimate the risks of local recurrence and metastasis. The 5-year risk of local recurrence was 10% for AFX and 17% for PDS. The 5-year risk of metastasis was 0.8% for AFX and 16% for PDS. PDS metastasized within 3 years. In 90% of the patients with lungs as the primary metastasis site. invasion beyond the subcutis, perineural intravascular infiltration, and increasing age significantly increase the risk of PDS relapse. The follow-up of patients with AFX can be limited to clinical visits for 4 years. Patients with PDS should be followed with clinical visits and PET CT imaging twice a year for the first 3 years and once a year for a minimum of 1 year.
My name is Amy Green, and I will be presenting the original article entitled Transcriptomic Analysis of Cutaneous Squamous Cell Carcinoma Reveals a Multi-Gene Prognostic Signature Associated with Metastasis. So as we know, cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma is the most common form of skin cancer with metastatic potential. Most cutaneous squamous cell skin cancers will have a favorable outcome, but there is a subset of patients that will progress to regional or distant metastatic disease. Current management could be improved by more accurately defining high-risk tumors. The current staging systems do have limitations in their ability to predict poor outcomes. Gene expression is being studied as a tool that could enhance the staging system's ability to prognosticate. The 40-gene gene expression profile by Castle Bioscience was recently developed for high-risk squamous cell skin cancer with a positive predictive value of 60% for highest-risk tumors and overall sensitivity, specificity, and positive predictive value for differentiating class 2, which is high-risk, and class 1, which is low-risk, of 65%, 69%, and 29% respectively. A completely unbiased approach to gene expression profiling is lacking, so these authors set out to develop a robust and validated gene expression profile signature for predicting cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma metastatic risk. So archival cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma tissue from 237 immunocompetent patients with known outcomes, 151 without metastasis and 86 with metastasis, were obtained from a multicenter cohort. Whole transcriptomic data was generated from the tumor as well as perilesional normal skin. Several machine learning techniques were then applied, and a 20-gene model was developed to differentiate metastasizing from non-metastasizing cutaneous squamous cell. A linear predictor based on the 20-gene gene expression profile was then developed. I will direct you towards the paper for a more in-depth description of the transcriptomics investigation and the machine learning techniques that were utilized. Demographic details for the patient as well as histologic features of the tumor can be seen in Table 1. Of note, there were several significant tumor characteristic differences between the two cohorts, as to be expected. Tumors in the metastasizing group were more likely to be on the head and neck region, larger diameters, greater percent with perineural as well as lymphovascular invasion, as well as higher AJCC and Brigham and Women's staging. Four sample groups were compared: metastasizing, non-metastasizing, and matched perilesional skin. Differential gene expression analysis showed 1,038 genes were upregulated and 236 genes were downregulated in metastasizing versus non-metastasizing cutaneous squamous cell. Figure 1 shows the top dysregulated conical pathways between metastasizing and non-metastasizing tumors, cell cycle related DNA replication and repair, and immune pathways, which include BCR regulation, interferon, and IL-12 signaling, were all upregulated in metastatic squamous cell carcinoma, while the formation of the cornified envelope, keratinization, and many metabolic pathways were downregulated. Genetic signatures from perilesional skin were also analyzed, and differences were found, and that can be seen in supplementary Table 2. A set of 20 genes, which provided the best performance in differentiating the two cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma groups in the validation set, which was composed of 36 non-metastatic tumors and 21 metastatic tumors, was developed. In the validation set, the 20-gene expression signature had an accuracy of 86%, a sensitivity of 85.7%, and a specificity of 86%. Patients classified as high risk in the 20-GEP signature had significantly worse metastasis-free survival. So the 3-year metastasis-free survival for the low-risk group was 91.7%, and the
metastasis-free survival for the high risk was 21.7%. Prognostic accuracy of the 20 GEP was then compared to our current staging systems, which can be seen in Table 2. The accuracy of AJCC8 in Brigham and women was 85.4% and 81.8% respectively, compared to the 20 GEP with a accuracy of 86%, suggesting that the 20 GEP had strong correlation with staging for risk prediction in the validation set. The linear predictor for metastasis was generated for the 20 GEP signature and had high correlation with metastatic risk, with the AUC of 0.85 and 0.88 for both the training and validation sets, respectively. Although the prognostic accuracy of our current staging systems performed really well in this study, their predictive accuracy varies widely across studies. The 20 GEP was developed and validated in this UK cohort of immunocompetent patients and achieved a very high accuracy of 86%, a negative predictive value of 91.2%, and a positive predictive value of 78.3%. The retrospective nature of the study and the small validation size does suggest there needs to be larger prospective studies, but this definitely adds to the literature and provides a potential additional tool to prognosticate patients.
This is Tara Jennings, and I will be reviewing the research letter, Combination of Acetaminophen and Ibuprofen is Non-Inferior to Acetaminophen and Hydrocodone for Postnail Procedure Analgesia, a randomized control trial by first author Jonathan Huang and senior author Sherry Lipner. In this study, 20 patients who underwent nail surgery between January 2022 and May 2023 were included. For intraoperative pain, all patients received ethyl chloride spray and a wing block consisting of 1% lidocaine and 0.75% ropivacaine prior to the surgery. For postoperative analgesia, patients were randomized into two groups. The first group received hydrocodone 5 mg and acetaminophen 325 mg every 4 hours. The second group received acetaminophen 1,000 mg and ibuprofen 400 mg every 6 hours as needed. Both regimens started 6 hours after the surgery until day 2. Pain levels were assessed twice daily until day 6. Impact of pain on quality of life was assessed on days 3 and 6. The results of this study showed that the overall mean pain score 6 hours postoperatively was 6, decreasing 0.8 points per day until day 6. There was no difference in mean pain scores from day 0 to day 2 between the two groups. The overall mean quality of life impact score on day 3 was 20 out of a total score of 120. This decreased to 8.4 on day 6. Again, there was no difference in the quality of life impact scores between groups. Authors noted that the pain scores with the combination of ropivacaine and lidocaine was similar to that of lidocaine alone in a prior study, indicating that ropivacaine may not improve pain scores after nail surgery. In summary, the study demonstrated that nail surgery patients experienced moderate to severe pain peaking 6 to 12 hours post-surgery, and that acetaminophen and ibuprofen is non-inferior to acetaminophen and hydrocodone for pain management up to 48 hours postoperatively. This study had its limitations with sample size and single-centered study, but does corroborate other studies indicating that nail surgery patients experience moderate to severe pain after surgery and that further solutions are necessary to improve the patient experience. This is Tara Jennings reviewing the original article, The Impact of the COVID-19 Pandemic in 2020 on the Diagnosis, Treatment, and Outcomes of Invasive Cutaneous Melanoma, a retrospective national cohort study by David Cheong and senior author Jeremy Bordeaux. Prior studies on this topic have shown that melanomas diagnosed during the COVID-19 pandemic have increased Breslow depth, ulceration, mitotic rate, stage of diagnosis, and more aggressive histologic subtypes compared to melanomas diagnosed prior to the pandemic. However, these studies have been limited to single or multi-institutional studies. This was a retrospective population-based cohort study utilizing the SEER registry of patients diagnosed with invasive cutaneous melanoma from 2018 to 2020. The objective of the study was to investigate the effect of the COVID-19 pandemic on cutaneous melanoma presentation, treatment, and survival. Overall, a total of about 60,000 melanomas were included in this study. Of note, the cohort of patients diagnosed with cutaneous melanoma in 2020 in the SEER database was the smallest cohort of patients since 2012, showing a 15.5% reduction of cases from 2019 to 2020. This reduction could reflect the patients who delayed their diagnosis or were unable to access healthcare during the pandemic, and it is important to keep this in mind when discussing the results of this study. The results of this study showed that a diagnosis of melanoma in 2020 was associated with an increased odds of having increased Breslow thickness, increased ulceration, increased nodular melanoma subtype, and increased stage of diagnosis. Patients tended to be older, from more urban and affluent areas, and more likely to be treated with Mohs micrographic surgery. Interestingly, patients diagnosed had significantly less treatment delays, which opposes the results from other studies on this topic. Despite increased stage at diagnosis, a diagnosis of cutaneous invasive melanoma in the year 2020 was not correlated with overall or disease-specific survival. Authors note that the survival data should be taken with a grain of salt, as there may be a selection bias in the current data set, as only patients who sought out care and had access to care are included in the SEER database, which is especially pertinent given the significant drop in patients in 2020, potentially due to the pandemic. Furthermore, patients in the study had a maximum of 11 months of follow-up, and thus we are only capturing survival 1 year after diagnosis. In summary, the study showed that patients diagnosed with melanoma in 2020 were more likely to have increased Breslow depth, ulceration, nodular tumors, and more advanced stage of diagnosis despite less treatment delays. Diagnosis in the year 2020 was not correlated with overall or disease-specific survival. Overall, this was an excellent retrospective study which captured important data regarding cutaneous melanomas diagnosed during the pandemic. I look forward to future studies on this unique patient population and am intrigued to see how data on survival may change with longer follow-up times.
This is Kim Tosco, and I'll be reviewing trends in efficacy of empiric antibiotic administration in Mohs micrographic surgery, a global propensity-matched retrospective cohort study in the December issue of JAD. Surgical site infection is the most common complication in Mohs micrographic surgery, yet the role for perioperative empiric antibiotic therapy is uncertain, yet performed routinely in up to 75% of Mohs surgeons. This population-based retrospective cohort study was performed using TriNetX analytics network platform, which enabled authors access to electronic medical record data from 321,863 patients who underwent Mohs surgery. 22% received perioperative empiric antibiotics, most commonly cefalexin, followed by doxycycline, then clindamycin. 0.12% of patients were diagnosed with surgical site infection within 1 month of surgery. The rate was 0.11% in patients who received perioperative antibiotics and 0.025% in those who did not. This study concludes that perioperative empiric antibiotic therapy was not associated with significant improvement in the risk of surgical site infections. This is Kim Tosco, and I'll be reviewing stage-specific risk of recurrence and death from melanoma in Denmark, 2008 to 2021, in the most recent issue of JAMA Dermatology. Authors sought to estimate stage-specific recurrence and melanoma-specific mortality rates, assess absolute stage-specific risks of recurrence and mortality, and describe stage-specific recurrence patterns, including conditional rates. The study was a nationwide, population-based, retrospective cohort study of prospectively collected clinical and pathologic data from 5 Danish national registries of 25,720 patients who are diagnosed with first-time invasive cutaneous melanoma. Patients with stage 2B to 2C melanoma were found to be older, had more comorbidities at diagnosis, and had the lowest rate of pathologic staging by central lymph node biopsy. A total of 10.6% of patients developed recurrence. First recurrence included distant recurrence alone or with synchronous local regional recurrence in 56.6% of patients. authors found a comparable risk of recurrence in stages 3A and 2B and in stages 3B and 2C. Melanoma-specific mortality was comparable between stages 3A and 2A and between stages 3B and 2B. These risk patterns persisted in cause-specific hazard models. This nationwide population-based cohort study found that increasing stages of the current AJCC8 staging system do not accurately reflect an increasing risk of recurrence and mortality in melanoma. The high proportion of distant recurrences suggests that hematogenous spread is a more common metastatic pathway than previously assumed, and surveillance with routine functional and cross-sectional imaging should be considered for stages 2B to 4. Future efforts should be put towards developing new tools for risk stratification and determining the survival effect of routine imaging in surveillance.
This is Yessel Kim, and I'll be reviewing an original investigation in December's JAD, Sebaceous Carcinoma Epidemiology, Associated Malignancies, and Lynch/Muir-Torre Syndrome Screening in England from 2008 to 2018 by first author Sam Cook and senior author Neil Rajan. Sebaceous carcinomas may be associated with the cancer predisposition syndrome, Muir-Torre or Lynch syndrome, identified by mismatch repair, MMR, screening. The authors aim to describe the epidemiology of sebaceous carcinomas, co-presentation of other cancers, and population-level frequency of MMR screening in sebaceous carcinomas. In turn, they are hoping to identify the proportion of sebaceous carcinomas screened for MMR and the proportion found to be MMR deficient to inform clinical guidelines on the need for systematic MMR screening of all sebaceous carcinomas as part of an ongoing drive toward comprehensive Lynch syndrome detection in patients presenting with Lynch syndrome-associated cancers. This study included all patients with histologically confirmed cutaneous sebaceous carcinoma between 2008 to 2018 in England. Data was obtained from the National Cancer Registration and Analysis Service. Sebaceous carcinoma pathology reports were manually reviewed to confirm the diagnosis and site and extract MMR immunohistochemical data. In total, 1,077 patients were confirmed as being diagnosed with sebaceous carcinoma. Median age was 76 with a male-to-female ratio of 1.4 to 1. Extraocular sebaceous carcinomas accounted for 69% of cases, compared with 31% for periocular. A majority of tumors were low stage. Median survival was 6.8 years for men and 7.4 years for women, which is reduced compared to the median expected survival for similar age groups in England. The cause of death was available for 435 of patients and was related to sebaceous carcinomas in 3%. 32% recorded other types of cancer as cause of death. 19% of patients developed at least one other recognized Lynch syndrome-associated cancers, including colorectal cancer, uterine cancers, and salivary gland cancers. Significantly increased rates of Lynch syndrome-associated cancers were not observed in the periocular group. MMR immunohistochemical screening was reported only in 20% of cases, with an annual increase in testing over the study period. In cases where MMR IHC was performed, 32% of sebaceous carcinomas were found to be deficient in MMR. These patients tended to be younger, with a higher frequency of extraocular lesions and periocular lesions. Sebaceous carcinoma linkage to germline DNA MMR testing results was identified in 56 patients, 25 of whom had MMR IHC testing of their tumor. In 54% of these patients, germline testing identified MMR deficiency consistent with Muir-Torre syndrome. 50% of those with MMR-deficient tumors by immunohistochemistry were identified to have germline pathogenic variants, and one patient was found to have a germline pathogenic variant despite normal IHC. The authors found that one-third of sebaceous carcinoma cases tested had MMR deficiency, and that cancer risk among patients with sebaceous carcinoma is high. The authors argue that the incorporation of tumor IHC MMR screening into clinical practice guidelines will increase the opportunity for Muir Torre diagnoses for patients and family members who may benefit from cancer surveillance. However, although these authors argue for the routine IHC testing of tumors for MMR, prior studies have shown that MMR IHC evaluation on sebaceous neoplasms is prone to false positive results, with an estimated false positive rate of 56%. This study also does not comment on the Mayo Muir Torre syndrome risk scoring system that appears to be better at identifying whether patients who present with sebaceous neoplasm are in need for further Lynch syndrome evaluation.
This is Yessel Kim, and I'll be reviewing an original investigation in the Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery Journal, Intra-Arterial Thrombolytic Treatment for Visual Deficits Caused by Hyaluronic Acid Filler, Efficacy, Safety, and Prognostic Factors by first author Ying Liang Wang and senior author Bin Sheng. HA fillers may lead to severe complications such as visual deficits resulting from embolization of the ophthalmic or central retinal artery. Hyaluronidase is an effective treatment option for HA-related ischemic complications. However, its efficacy in reversing visual deficits remain unclear, and no therapeutic modalities have been consistently successful. One treatment option for HA-related visual deficits is retrobulbar hyaluronidase injections. However, most studies have shown the lack of a significant improvement in visual acuity by this modality. In the past decade, studies have increasingly reported the efficacy of intraarterial thrombolytic treatment with hyaluronidase, most being case reports. Therefore, the authors aim to report their 5-year experience in the treatment of visual deficits related to HA by intraarterial thrombolytic treatment in their medical center. This was an observational study from 2015 to 2021 of patients with HA-related visual deficits who underwent intraarterial thrombolytic treatment, IATT. Patients with HA-associated visual deficits underwent IATT at the earliest possible time, thrombolytic agents hyaluronidase and or vasodilator papaverine was slowly injected into the occlusive artery, followed by mechanical recanalization of the occluded artery by a microguide wire. After recanalization, angiography was performed to detect the blood flow of the occluded artery. Assessment of post-op complications, clinical symptoms, skin changes, eyeball and eyelid motility, and visual acuity at 24 hours, 1 week, 2 weeks, 1 month, 3 month, and 6 months were done. A total of 72 patients were analyzed, 93% were women, mean age was 29.3 years. All patients had unilateral visual deficits. Primary injection sites were forehead, nasal region, temporal region, and glabella. All patients had sudden visual deficits within 30 minutes after HA injection, of whom 55% exhibited no light perception. Ocular motility disorders were observed in 87%, ptosis in 84%, and facial changes in 75%. All patients underwent successful recanalization of the ophthalmic and central retinal arteries with no procedure-related complications. During a mean follow-up of 4 months, all skin injuries were healed, ptosis disappeared, and ocular motility disorders were completely reversed. From the 40 patients with no light perception at admission, the median time interval between visual deficits and treatment was 23.5 hours. After treatment, visual acuity in 9 patients was immediately improved. 32 patients exhibited preserved visual acuity at admission. The median time interval between visual deficits and treatment was 31 hours. And after treatment, 17 patients showed improved visual acuity immediately. This study was a retrospective observational study of 72 patients who successfully underwent recanalization of the occluded artery with intraarterial thrombolytic treatment, with all skin injuries, ptosis, and ocular motility disorders that were completely healed and improved visual acuity in 26 of the 72 patients.
Therefore, intra-arterial thrombolytic treatment for selective patients with HA-related visual deficits is efficient and safe.
Thank you for listening to Derm Surgery Digest, the official podcast of the Dermatologic Surgery Journal. To access these featured articles, author videos, and much more, visit journals.lww.com/dermatologicsurgery. To learn more about the American Society for Dermatologic Surgery, visit asds.net.